effect of this is that I have more degrees of freedom than I have constraints. So that, in general, that leads to things like history dependence and so forth. Okay, so let me just quickly remind you how big the fluctuations can be in response to, say, something like steady shearing. So this was done by Brian Miller a number of years ago now. But the idea was he was shearing a layer in an annular container, looking opposite the shearing surface at pressure fluctuations, so the mean pressure was down here. And then over time, the fluctuations that he observed were, in fact, typically in the range, of course, of the mean up to well over an order of magnitude greater than the mean pressure in the system. Okay, so I get to use my own picture for once. Okay. So here there are the famous force chains, which come about in response to shearing. And you can actually tell that there's a preferred sense of shearing in the system. So there's a little tilt to these force chains, which tells you that it was actually being sheared in that direction. OK, good. So let's just, actually, I think it's fun to look at this. Sometimes a look is worth more than 10 PowerPoint pages. So this is actually now a close-up, relatively close-up view. You can see the shearing wheel and the force chains which now form. And then so this is order 10 grains, but of course these forces propagate all the way across the system. Okay, I'll let that run. By the way, these are photoelastic particles. They're birefringent under strain. The little dark bars on them are so we can track the orientation and centroid of the system, each particle. Okay, so in the static state, okay, good. Okay, so in the static state, say in 2D, one can write down stress balance, and at the end of the day, you need to have a constitutive equation, and what you'd really like to do is you would like to understand from a microscopic point of view how to write down such a description. And in fact, you'd like to know something about how forces are carried at the microscale. OK, so just a quick listing of some of the various attempts to do this, right? Elastoplastic models from the engineering world, for instance, are an intuitive idea about how granular material should perform in response to stresses. So they're typically elliptic. That is in the elastic state, and when they yield, they're plastic and they become hyperbolic. Okay, the Q model is, I think, the first attempt at a lattice model, so a microscopic picture. That's parabolic, it's a diffusion equation. Various other types of models. So actually, the bottom line here is that one can pick almost any type of model out there to try to describe the way forces are carried in a granular system. And so in the end, that's nice for experimentalists because, well, I mean, you actually have something to settle, hopefully. Okay, so now let me, with that quick overview, let me then start turning to various experiments. And the first one here is actually an experiment where now we're preparing specific granular states in a biaxial system. So these are photoelastic particles, so we will measure the forces at the grain scale. We'll actually measure the contact forces in this experiment. And so the idea is two of the walls can be moved, two remain stationary, and that way you can create any state of deformation that you care to do. Okay. So now what I want to do is, so this is just a mnemonic of how the biax works. This is actually an image of a particular particle, and you can see it has this complex pattern of light and dark. And what I particularly want to call to your attention is the rather dramatic difference in the force structure when you isotropically compress versus one where you shear, which means that you push down on these two sides but expand it on the other two. Okay, so it's compressed in the vertical and dilated in the. Okay, so those are the principal axes.
This is not a shear. This is
the intentional. No. It's pure shear.
Intentional meaning in, it's pure shear.
Right.
Pure shear is like this.
No, that's simple shear. I think. Okay. So this is what I call pure shear in any event. And No, so this is not compressed at all. Okay, so it starts from a state in which there are no obvious contacts, but it's just about to touch, and then it's compressed along that way and dilated that way. Simultaneously, right? Okay.
There are isotropic stress in there.
And so there is presumably no isotropic stress, whereas this one clearly does. Okay. So that one, right? Okay. Okay. Good question. So thank you. You're my straight man. Okay. All right. So the idea is now that you get these patterns of light and dark, and you would like to be able to relate them to the actual forces, and that's exactly the right question. And so now the trick is that there are two pieces to doing this analysis in the end. Again, we're looking at these systems through cross polarizers, and the systems are birefringent under strain. Okay, so here's the basics of the problem that you're dealing with. If you look at the intensity that you see coming through any pixel in your image, that depends on the incoming intensity, which is sort of irrelevant. It depends on the square of the sine of now this argument, which is the difference in principal stresses, property of the photoelastic material, the sample thickness, and the wavelength. Okay. That's what you actually have. Okay, now the principal stresses at that given point are determined by the elastic response of the disks. And now, the trick that we're going to use is the fact that if I give you a disk, okay, a two-dimensional object, and I apply any number n of forces, contact forces on that disk, there is a classical solution which depends linearly on those forces. Okay, so I can compute the stress field, okay, with the forces in principle as unknown parameters to be fitted. Okay, and so now what I need to do is have an algorithm which takes an image which contains all that kind of information. Okay, so we'll go back and look. So something like this. Okay, and now I have to be able to look at that pattern, okay, take my classical solution that I know, which is actually a pretty good solution for this kind of system of particles, okay, and do the inverse problem, which tells me the forces. Okay, so I'd like to know the forces of the contacts, basically taking this classical solution and this relation between the stresses and the photoelastic intensity. Okay, so that's what we're doing. Okay, so it's a nonlinear inverse problem. Okay, that's what we have to do. And it's this guy, sine squared of something that sweeps through multiple wraps of pi, that is the bugaboo that makes this a difficult issue. Okay, but nevertheless, okay, it is possible to do this, and we're not the first to do it, by the way. So there are engineers who love to play with photoelasticity, because before finite element codes, this was the way that people oftentimes evaluated an engineering design. They would cut out their bridge or the building out of a slice of photoelastic material and load it up, okay, and then try to solve this kind of problem. Okay. What's unique now in what we're doing is that we're able to automatically process large volumes of data, okay, so many, many disks in order to get statistical information out of this kind of system. Okay, so these are two examples from the experiment. Okay, these are original images, and these demonstrate, if you like, the quality of this inverse fitting procedure. Okay, and we thresholds, so you'll notice some of the weaker particles don't show up here. Okay, and that's because anything which is roughly 10% or smaller than the mean, we don't process in the current approach. So. I don't offhand know. I mean, the contact numbers for this kind of system, which is a sheared system, is a little bit bigger than 3, and these are approaching 4. Okay, if that helps. So now, the amusing thing is, okay, we can now go back. We get the contact forces at the end of the day from this analysis, and we distinguish now not only the magnitude of the contact force, but we determine whether these are tangential or normal. Okay, so then we can investigate each distribution independently, And one of the amusing things is that if you look at these red data that are the tangential forces, they are, in fact, nice, clean exponentials, what everyone sort of expects to see. Okay, but if one looks at the normal forces, those are quite sensitive to the way you prepare the system. And in the sheared system, the normal forces, so they have a rise to a peak around the mean, but then these fall off perhaps even more slowly than exponentially. Whereas in the compression case, so isotropic compression, they fall off faster than exponential. And by the way, the normalization is such that we have, regardless of which component of the force, the frictional, tangential, or the normal force, we're normalizing by the mean value of the normal force. So the tangential forces are actually relatively small here. Okay. And you can sort of see that again by looking at the mobilization of the forces. So this is the values distributions for the tangential over normal force divided by the friction coefficient. So you know, if you had a lot of ones, then you say you have a lot of strong tangential frictional forces, but that isn't what it is. Okay. So now let me quickly compare to a couple of rather recent models for now forces, and these only actually cover normal forces, but they both point to the fact that the normal force distributions should care about whether how you prepared your system, and that sheared systems are not like isotropically compressed systems. So the basic idea of both of these computations is to take an Edwards entropy principle and say, okay, we'll look at all possible combinations of a given configuration of particles subject to whatever stresses. And what we'll do is we'll then look at those fractions for which there's at least one contact force of size F. That's the principle in a few words. And both of these kinds of calculations agree that if you look at compressional distributions, the normal forces, and again, these only have normal forces, fall off faster than exponential. But as you shear the system, your normal forces should actually start to move out in the tail. So that actually seems the data seems rather consistent with these models. Now, the one piece which I think has not been investigated by theory, but I think is rather interesting, is if you now look at the force-force correlation function in these systems, right? So you know, here's a quick aside. If I show you force chains in an experiment, then you'll say, okay, well, what in the heck is a force chain? Okay. Those of you who have played around with trying to identify these kinds of things know that in fact, it's very arbitrary. So throw that out for the moment and say, look, I'll look at the magnitude of the force on a particle. So by which I mean, I take each contact force, take its magnitude, and take the mean of that. And I'll then look at the correlation function of that in along preferred directions in the sheared system, which are the force chain direction or transverse. And so in these samples, which are, you know, only tens of particles in a given direction, you know, 20 or 30 particles, along that strong force chain direction, you have something you could, don't look too closely, is more or less power law-like. Okay, it has relatively long-range correlations. Okay, if you fit a power law to that, the exponent is minus 0.8. Okay, in the compressed system, and in the direction perpendicular to the chains in the sheared system, the correlations are very short range. No, by a chain. Yeah. You do it in all directions, okay? And then this is the direction where you have the longest range correlation, and it corresponds by what you see by eye.
Well, you don't have to answer the question if you think it's more appropriate for the discussion.
Okay.
When we were young, we were taught that you could do a lot of statistical mechanics using relatively uncorrelated approximations.
Uh-huh.
And then there were problems like near critical points,
right,
where you needed to include correlations,
uh-huh,
and so forth.
Right.
One of the things that I find puzzling about conversations about force change.
Right.
I never know what's the uncorrelated theory that's in the back of, that could be in the back of our minds.
Right.
So, regarding these as corrections.
Right. So let me give a quick answer, and maybe we can discuss it more. But what I would suggest is that we haven't, as a community, particularly worried too much about correlations in granular systems. That is, it's frequently taken as an assumption that correlations are always short-range because you have short-range interactions. So this is, if you like, merely a statement that we have to be careful, and it raises the possibility that correlations in certain cases are longer range than we had appreciated. So now, how long range they are, I don't know. I mean, this is 10 particles or 20 particles is not infinitely long range, but it's the system size. So one now wants to say, suppose that I start looking at bigger systems. How, you know, at what point can I ignore these correlations and think about, you know, well, I've now got something which is a block here and a block here that are uncorrelated. And you need to ask that question first before you start, I think, creating theories that assume there are no correlations. Is that fair enough? Yeah. I mean, that's all sort of in the works, okay. But really, of course, the key thing is that it depends on how you prepared your system. And so states of pure shear, starting from zero initial compression, are the ones that have the longest range correlation. So if I now add some hydrostatic compression on this, I shorten the range. Yeah. One would imagine, absolutely. These are relatively disordered. They're bidispersed, but they're not. I mean, there's still some little bit of local order. So. How do I compute? Okay, I compute in all directions. I just go around a whole. No. Don't worry about chains. Okay, I take a distance, just like any density correlation function. So I take a value of my property. The mean magnitude of force here and there, okay, and then I look at a given distance, all the given distances, but I keep the direction in the problem. I don't make an average over all angles. I simply average over all particles separated by a given vector position. Okay, is that clear? Okay, so now. So force response, you like to know what happens if I poke on a system of these particles. I want to quickly look at this because, I want to move on to some dynamic things too. Okay, so the idea is I have an array of these particles, I'm going to push on them, okay, and I want to know something about how the system responds to that push. Okay. So now we're going to use a cruder but still reasonably effective approach to photoelastic techniques, which is to say, okay, and if I want, I can determine by calibration the average force on a particle by looking at the density of these light and dark fringes. So this is false color, right? Okay, I mean, it looks pretty, but here the idea is red corresponds to a bright part of the image and blue to dark. Okay, so I can now apply on small samples a force per unit length on these discs, and then compare that to the gradient square of the intensity, which then gives me averaged over a particle, summed over a particle, for which I can get a pretty decent calibration of the mean force on a particle. That's what we're using here. Okay, and so now we're going to take stacks of these things, and so getting back to Sal's question, it matters whether it's ordered or not, and the answer sure does. So this is a nominally ordered packing of hexagonal packing of disks, but remember there's a caveat, which is because I've got multiple contacts, the friction can actually be uncertain at the contact, right? It will depend on how I put the system together. Okay, and so there's a degree of disorder in the system that one doesn't see simply by looking at the positions of the particles. Okay. So that's important to keep in mind. Okay. So now, let me show you before and after pictures. So here's my starting stack of particles. It's oriented almost in the vertical, but not quite, so that I don't have friction with the plate on which it's resting. Okay, so that's the idea. But then I have a gravitational head, but I want the change in response to an applied force. So there's the applied force. And now I look at the difference, frankly. So before, after the force is applied, difference. Okay. If I stir up my system, even though the positions of the particles haven't changed particularly, the contact forces have changed. And so now, if I do the experiment with gently stirring up the system, every time I will see a different response. Okay? All right. And in fact, well, okay. So what I want to do is look at the ensemble response. And in fact, when I do that, so this is a color scale representation of the mean over 50 trials. And what's happening is the force is propagating preferentially down lattice directions on average, okay, with a little bump in the middle. Okay. So at first sight, that looks like a hyperbolic response, right? So in two dimensions, a hyperbolic response is down two lines, the characteristics. Yeah. Right, okay, so what we actually do is we then look along these lines and try to determine whether the response appears within experimental resolution linear. So these are always done at what we think is the limit of the linear regime. Okay, but again, you know, it's conceivable that we're actually in a nonlinear regime and can't tell it, but that's anyway, okay, the intent is to be in the linear regime. Okay, but now here's a warning. If you now look at the variance, the RMS over these 50 ensembles, in fact, it looks just like the mean response. And if you look at the distribution of RMS to mean, okay, it's actually some, you know, simple, relatively simple-looking peak function, but the peak is around 2. Okay, think about that. Okay, all right. So now pentagons. Okay, so these are disordered packings of disordered particles, right? So we've gone the other extreme. Okay, this is as disordered as we can make it, we think. Okay, this actually is a single blob, so there's no question that this is hyperbolic. And let me remind you that if it were an elastic material, an elastic sheet, and we were pushing, then the stress components would have stresses that scale with depth, z, okay, in a form like this. So the width of this thing, right, this is sort of a Lorentzian type shape, that thing would broaden linearly with z. And in fact, when we look at the width of this response versus z, okay, it's pretty clearly consistent with a linear broadening. Okay, so that now says depending on how you want to cut it, you can have either something that looks hyperbolic or looks elastic, and that doesn't seem too satisfying. Okay, just a quick comment, as these are bidispersed systems of increasing amounts of disorder, and you can see just a barely trace of sort of a two-peak response in this nearly monodispersed system, which has disappeared with a modest amount of polydispersity. Okay. All right. So now, on the other hand, you would also like to get rid of friction, so we're sort of back on the idea of increasing the order of the system by getting rid of spurious extra contact, not spurious, but extra contacts. So going to a square structure is about as good as we can do. And indeed, what happens is, if you compare a hexagonal to a square packing, you see that by reducing the amount of friction disorder, you actually get stronger propagation along these lattice directions. And if you then make the particles slipperier, so these are rough particles and these are slippery particles, you get even sharper propagation along the lattice directions. Okay. So now, all right. So then, is there any way to see these as being manifestations of a single process? Okay. And so this was actually something that Isaac Goldhirsch and Chai Goldenberg had proposed. So they said, well, look, these particles are probably interacting by spring-like forces. We'll make a simple model of interacting springs, particles interacting by springs. And so then their assertion, which could help unify these two pictures, is to say that depending on the force, and this is actually getting back to David question, right? How linear is this? So their contention is that if the force is relatively strong and the friction is low, then even though the forces are strictly elastic particle to particle, you'll get a two-peak response. And as you go to higher friction and very small forces, that elastic-like response will merge to one peak. So this is, if you like, induced anisotropy, but still elastic. Okay.
What they mean by friction is the strength of the tangential stiffness.
Exactly.
I don't know what I call that friction.
Okay, yeah, right. But if you want to try to translate it into physical terms, you might say it's friction. Because it determines your yield strength. Anyway. So time has gone on. I want to really have a bit of time left to talk about what happens when the system now starts to move and is unjammed. And so we'll see how far I get before Bob gets out the hook. Okay, so, all right. So the first system I want to look at, again, somewhat briefly, concerns a system of particles. These are now 3D spherical particles. They're polystyrene spheres. They're about 3 millimeters in diameter, okay, and they're being sheared from above. So this actually is an apparatus which is in the horizontal plane is cylindrically symmetric, but now it's taken a vertical cut right along the diameter. So you see the particles are in an annular region. The top is rotating and providing shear. The bottom is pushing up with actually something that can vibrate, but also applies some force through a spring. Okay. So now what happens is that these systems show ordered and disordered states, and so the motivation, by the way, to do these experiments was to actually heat them up by shaking them. Okay, that was intent. Okay, and create a disordered state by vibrating, so we get to something more fluid-like. And actually, I'm going to skip the movies because time is running short for the moment. Okay. Now the interesting thing is that this expectation was, in fact, not even remotely realized. So, in fact, when you shake the system hard relative to the shearing, it crystallizes. Okay, so that's... Go back here. Okay. So this is the crystal state, and the system finds that by virtue of being vibrating. And this is the disordered state, which, perhaps not surprisingly, the system finds by being sheared. So there's a phase diagram of ordered crystalline states, and they're really 3D crystal states. We can pull the system apart, unpack it, and so forth and so on, and it's actually an HCP crystal. These are disordered states, okay? And notice this is on a log scale for the shearing rate at the top. So this system is actually strengthening logarithmically in this disordered state.
Is it actually HCP or is it one of these random?
No, it appears to be truly, it's not one like A, B, C, A, B, A, that sort of thing. It really is A, B, C, or whatever. It's hexagonal close pack, whichever one that, A, B, right in the right plane, A, B. Yeah, okay. So, but it is actually retains some order in the direction of the horizontal plane, and you can see that in the spatial autocorrelation function. It's a little hard. Okay, so this is presumably in these two are in the ordered state, and when you get to the disordered state, you see only in-plane correlation. Although, what that really means is you have little chunks of material which are correlated, and then the rest of, the, and then you have a finite range for those things, so it's not really long range. Okay, stress distributions. Okay, so if you at the bottom of this container is a pressure gauge of sorts. And what we look at in the ordered state is something that looks like a two-peak hump, which is basically the PDF of a sinusoidal function. So where does that come from? It means that the whole chunk of ordered material is going up and down en bloc. Okay, and that's why you see such a PDF. At the transition point, in this vicinity, of the disordered system is where, in fact, the PDF of the forces at the bottom is stretched out the most. Okay, and in fact, if you look at the kurtosis of these force distributions, you find that it's actually relatively strongly cusped as you come down from the disordered state and fall into the ordered state. Okay, so there's actually now a phase diagram of crystallized and disordered, and the phase boundary between these two appears to occur when, so gamma is this shaking acceleration in dimensionless units. So the phase boundary occurs when the energy input per particle from shaking equals the energy input per particle from shear. That's okay. Right. Right. That was our expectation too. Okay. Yes, I agree. It's, you would think. Well, okay. I mean, it's conceivable, but I mean, it's, you know, up to gammas of 10, which are pretty robust amounts of shaking. Okay. Okay. So one last point, since time is fleeting on. When one looks at in the vicinity of the transition point, then one has extraordinarily long and large force fluctuations, which are then characteristic of that transition. Okay. So now, okay. So I think I'm down to just 2 or 3 minutes. So what I'm going to do is actually just briefly talk about experiments where we now want to characterize diffusion in back to 2D photoelastic systems. So this wheel will now be turning. It generates a shear band. And now also a characteristic velocity profile, which is whatever it is. Okay, so here's the velocity profile over radial distance from that shearing wheel. And you have to work pretty hard to get it, by the way, because there are issues of aliasing and so forth, depending on your camera rate and so forth. So that is not totally trivial. Michel Luge has a very nice paper that deals with this, by the way. Okay, if one looks at the diffusion of particles in that shear band, which is a very non-uniform flow, then along the radial direction, it looks as though the variances that one computes depart from linear, so it looks like it's actually sub-diffusive for radial diffusion, super-diffusive for tangential diffusion. But in actual fact, we think that's simply due to the fact that the system is actually suffering from things like Taylor dispersion, a rigid boundary. So if we do a truly Brownian random walk model of this process, we get, with the right velocity profile in the system, we get in the model and in the experiment basically the same behavior. So we think that's really Brownian motion going on. But again, that's hard to say. And in the system, and so we then went to a different system. So I'm going to skip over that for the moment. And so this is a system, again, of a channel of particles, but we have a much more uniform sheared flow in the system by putting in little bars into the top of the flow, rods, which then stir the flow gently and create a diffusing state. And so, yeah, well, okay, so we can look at that. Okay, come on. Time's wasting. Okay. Well, okay, so it's over. Okay. Good. So now what you're seeing is a particle which is being held fixed in that system, and the particles are now moving past. Okay, and so now, come on. Okay. So then, if one looks at diffusion in this system, which we hope to do, okay, these are PDFs of particle displacements as a function of time, and this is a very simple diffusing system. Okay, so now I see Bob is standing up, which is a bad sign. Okay, so let me show one more thing and move to the conclusions. Okay, so here, this is so one last interesting point about this system, is that if we look now at the mean force that a tracer particle feels as it's being dragged through the system versus the density or packing fraction of the system, there is a rather interesting transition, which is, I think, surely related to jamming So below that point, okay, the system is in fact able to push particles aside without training any force change, and the force just grows linearly in sort of the number of these particles that it encounters. And then all of a sudden it leaps up and follows something more like a power law with an exponent of 3/2, which is now in this more or less jammed state. Okay, so again, I won't talk more than Bob will let me. So let me just move on to a few quick conclusions. So take away the normal force distributions that one sees in these systems care about how you prepare the system. So all granular states are not equal, and all PDFs of forces should not be the same. There appear to be long-range correlations in pure shear. Again, that will depend on other details of how you put it together, as we've seen. Okay, so more or less, if one now looks at the force response, it appears that an elastic-like description is the best overall description of what's going on, but you may need to worry about various kinds of induced anisotropy. We've looked at a first-order order-disorder transition, which is a surprising feature that vibration actually creates order in the system, not disorder. And there were some more things on diffusion and so forth, which we sort of looked at a fleeting thing. So, thanks. Yeah, Tom.
We know in equilibrium systems that you can reduce the significance of fluctuations by going higher dimensionality.
Mm-hmm.
Presumably, you can't image force change between them.
Right. Well, no one has.
You can look at fluctuations in stress boundaries in 3D versus 2D shear systems.
Mm-hmm.
Can you comment on any direction that you're thinking about this?
So, for instance, in 2D systems, such as the one where we're looking at the intruder moving through a bath, you see the same qualitative type of fluctuations, which are sort of characterized by a spectrum which is flat up to something which is really set by the shear rate of the system, and then a 1 over F square fall off. So the qualitative nature doesn't change necessarily. The strength of the fluctuations in both 3D and 2D depends strongly on things like packing fraction, mean stress, so forth and so on. So there's no immediate indication that change of dimension in this case it makes the physics totally different. That is, from going to 2 to 3. And maybe by the time you go from, go to 10, then maybe all bets are off.
I'm interested in the ensemble of packing configurations explored in the pictured animal experiment and how that might be influenced by the compliance of the particles. Do you need to feel what sort of strain is out there?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Sure. Sure. Right. Okay. So, in the 2D shear experiments we're talking about, a big strain would be 1%. Okay. So, would it change? Could be. I would make you a bet that a more important parameter is actually the friction rather than the elasticity. But again, changing both of those in a systematic way, as you know only too well, is not a trivial proposition. Right. Right. I mean, of course, that's everyone's immediate reaction is it looks like lightning. I don't understand lightning, so I guess I don't.
This is probably much better understood than lightning.
Okay. So maybe we'll learn something about lightning by studying. Okay. Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Right. Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Right. I think they're right. So I'm going to make things worse for you, okay? Because, of course, what you're looking at is the ensemble average. Whereas if one looks at a true elastic sheet, okay, one is doing a one-time visualization of the stresses in that system, right? So you can, of course, do a photoelastic punch test on a piece of photoelastic material, and of course you'll see the light and dark bands. So you know, again, the caveat is that this is only in the ensemble, and in fact, in a single experiment, you have a complex tangle of responses. Okay. Right. Sure. So I mean, to say it's truly elastic is I think excessive. So it can only be elastic like in the mean. Okay, so I think that's I think your warning is well placed, and so there are other places where a truly elastic description doesn't seem to quite work. But it is, so what I would say is it's the closest description that we now have to describe these experiments. But not a perfect one by any means.
Right. By truly elastic, do you mean isotropic elastic?
But right, so no, I don't mean isotropic elastic. So there's distinctly some reason to believe that anisotropy is playing an important role, particularly in these systems where you see it propagate down the force axis.
That seems to me that's an answer to the question.
Well,
in fact, it's anisotropy that's playing an important role in directing.
Could be.